Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm John Geschke, partner at the law firm of Cooley Gobler Cronish, and your chair for tonight's program. Tonight's program is a part of a series of programs underwritten by the Geschke family, which examine the U.S. Constitution in the 21st century. Since the September 11th, 2001, al-Qaeda attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the U.S. has been on the equivalent of a wartime footing. This period of time has given rise to specific legislation and practices that present significant challenges to the core provisions of the U.S. Constitution protecting civil liberties and freedom of speech. There are challenges to the right of habeas corpus, challenges to the Posse Comitatus Act, which limits the powers of the federal government to use the military for law enforcement, and curtailment of First Amendment rights to free speech and freedom of assembly. An additional area of challenge, the practice of presidential exclusions, goes to the root of the separation of powers provided in the U.S. Constitution. Walking the line between protecting U.S. security and curbing the rights of U.S. citizens is a delicate business. A government's first duty is to protect its citizens against threats to their security. Yet starting down the path of restricting civil liberties can be a very slippery slope. The Commonwealth Club's series on the U.S. Constitution in the 21st century we'll examine the balance between the safety, security, and the public order on the one hand, and the protection of civil liberties and the integrity of the Constitution on the other. This series aims to break new ground by delving into recent interpretations of the U.S. Constitution and discussing potential new directions for the Obama administration. To this end, it's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, Vincent Warren. Mr. Warren is the Executive Director of the Center of Constitutional Rights, a national legal and educational organization dedicated to advancing and defending the rights guaranteed by the United States Constitution and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. As executive director, Mr. Warren oversees the center's groundbreaking litigation and advocacy work, which include combating policies such as detention at Guantanamo, rendition, torture, and warrantless wiretapping, holding corporations and government officials accountable for human rights abuses, and challenging racial injustice in mass incarceration. Mr. Warren has also spearheaded a public campaign, Beyond Guantanamo, Rescue the Constitution, coinciding with the center's landmark Supreme Court victory, confirming that the detainees at Guantanamo Bay have a constitutional right to the writ of habeas corpus. Prior to his tenure at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Mr. Warren held the position of National Senior Staff Attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. Mr. Warren has also monitored South Africa's historic Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings and worked as a criminal defense attorney for the Brooklyn Legal Aid Society. He holds a law degree from the Rutgers School of Law and a Bachelor of Arts from Haverford College. Mr. Warren's a frequent national cable and network television commentator, having appeared on CNN, the BBC, ABC, CBS, as well as national radio programs. Please join me in welcoming Vincent Warren.
Thank you all very much. I would love to thank the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to this, and also to thank the Geschke family for underwriting a critically important discussion about really that encompasses what is the fate of our Constitution moving forward. I thought in the time that I was going to be with you that it would make a little sense to talk about how we got here to this moment, talking about what our expectations were, at least from the Center for Constitutional Rights, as to how things would change under the Obama administration. And then, luckily, because of the timing of this talk, we can talk a little bit about President Obama's speech today in Washington, D.C., where he has unveiled his broad plans with respect to national security, specifically with the men in Guantanamo. In January of 2002, George Bush brought the first 20 men over to Guantanamo. And these were 20 people that he said, and Dick Cheney said, were the worst of the worst. These are the worst criminals you will ever see. They will bite your kids' heads off. But the good news is that they will never see a courtroom. They will be locked up until we say that they're not going to be locked up again, locked up anymore. They won't see lawyers. They won't have access to the courts. They won't have access to the International Committee of the Red Cross. They won't have access to their families because they're that dangerous. They were too dangerous, according to George Bush, to be able to do anything with them other than to lock them up until the Bush administration thought it was okay to let them go. Well, 1 month later, in February of 2002, the Center for Constitutional Rights, some death penalty lawyers, and a law firm filed the first series of habeas corpus cases with respect to these 20 men. And the idea then was, well, you can't have a system in which someone is detained indefinitely without any prospect of going to court to be able to be released if they're being held unlawfully. There's literally no check on the president's authority, acclaimed authority, to hold people unless people have access to courts. When we filed those habeas corpus cases in 2002, people thought we were crazy. People thought, how can you represent people who are terrorists? People thought, these guys are so dangerous, you're just trying to get them out of jail, Center for Constitutional Rights. And that's not something that we support. We pressed on anyway because we recognized that the Constitution is not a negotiable instrument. You can't negotiate the rights of people away based upon how you feel about their dangerousness at the time, how you feel about the things that they may be doing in the future, that we have these bedrock principles that require a person who was locked up to at least face a trial where they can be adjudicated in terms of guilt or innocence, or if the government doesn't want to do that, they have to have access to an independent court to determine whether they are being held lawfully or not. And that's really what the fight for habeas corpus was all about. It wasn't a get-out-of-jail-free card fight. It was a fight about the fundamental aspects of the rule of law. As we know now, in 2009, that fight that was started in 2002 went on through a series of court cases, a series of Supreme Court cases culminating last year in this case called Boumediene versus Bush. And this was the habeas corpus case where the Supreme Court actually for the second time recognized that the men in Guantanamo had habeas corpus rights, that they were allowed to go to court to have a judge to determine whether they were being held lawfully or not. So just leaving aside for a moment the immense struggle over those years with respect to being into court and trying to not release people, but just get them before a judge. We found ourselves at the end of the Bush administration, well, actually close to the end of the Bush administration, where there was so much public pressure as the Bush administration fought the habeas corpus provisions. There was so much pressure with respect to the concept of Guantanamo as a detention facility, with respect to the concept of Guantanamo as a place where there was a legal black hole. Of course, it's in Cuba because the Bush administration's view was if you house these guys outside of the continental United States or outside of offshore in the United States, then U.S. law doesn't apply. And because we're going to say, the Bush administration said, that they're actually not prisoners of war, the international law doesn't apply at all. So we can basically hold these guys as long as we want. That's why it was in Guantanamo. But we get to the point where the public pressure was building so much that was an untenable political position for George Bush. Guantanamo, to George Bush, and frankly to Dick Cheney, was nothing but a bad PR problem. Don't think for a minute that either one of those guys has any remorse or any second thoughts with respect to how they were thinking about that legally. But when we got to the point where the PR problem got so bad, George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and the military had to think of a mechanism to satisfy those of us on the left that were really pushing for some sort of legal adjudication for these men. And so they came up with this concept called the military commissions. I know that you've all heard the military commissions, but let me just tell you for a minute how military commissions differ from, under George Bush, how they differed from federal courts. And when I say federal courts, I'm talking about, you know, when the mobster or the terrorist gets arrested and they go before a federal judge with a jury, they have all of the rights that anybody who's a defendant have. They have the Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate themselves, the Sixth Amendment right to confront their accusers. They have the right to present evidence on their own behalves. That's what it's like in federal court. In the military commissions under George Bush, the first thing that he did was he said, well, you know, I recognize that Congress has the power to create courts and not the president, but I'm going to create one anyway. And he created this military commission system by executive order. He wrote it out. He said, this is what the system's going to look like. He signed it and made it so. That system didn't have a real judge. It was presided over by an appointee of the Secretary of Defense. That system did not allow for representation by people, defense representation. That system allowed the use of evidence of torture. That system did not allow people who were being accused to bring in evidence and witnesses against that support their position. It was a completely rigged system. It was designed only to get convictions. That's all it was. It didn't even make a pretense at due process. Well, we were among a group of lawyers that challenged the military commissions. In a case, excuse me, called Hamdan, we were very successful. The Supreme Court invalidated George Bush's military commission system. As a result of that, very soon after that, I think that decision came down in June 2006. By September 2006, the Republican Congress was on the case. And they said, well, if the president can't create a military system by executive order, we'll do it for him. So they passed the Military Commissions Act, which created essentially the same military commission system that George Bush had put into place. George Bush said, great, now we're going to take a handful of the worst of the worst. By that point, the government had already released 500 men from Guantanamo. There's been a total of 779 people. At that point, the government had released on its own 500, but they said, oh, but trust us, but the guys that we're keeping, these are the really bad guys. And lucky for you, we're not going to put them through federal courts where we don't trust federal judges, where the rules of evidence don't really work in our favor. We're going to put them in these special courts so we can ensure convictions. We challenged the Military Commissions Act as well in an interesting way. We tried to persuade Congress, don't do this. This is a terrible, terrible situation. You're going down the road, wrong road. Congress really wasn't listening to us. President Barack Obama was not supportive of the Military Commissions Act, as he was quick to point out in his speech today. But we ended up losing in Congress. They passed that act anyway. George Bush began these commissions cases. And some of the immediate people that they put before the military commissions were the so-called 9/11 conspirators, right? This is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and those guys. You've heard of all of those people. Well, there was another guy that was also in that group, and his name is Mohammed al-Qahtani. Now, Mohammed al-Qahtani was not charged with the 9/11 conspiracy. He was not charged with a lot of the things that the other folks were charged with. But what makes him special? Well, aside from the fact that he's a Center for Constitutional Rights client, he also had the distinction of arguably being the most tortured man, the most abused man in Guantanamo. Mohammed al-Qahtani was in Guantanamo and was routinely abused. He was. They would make him dress up. They would sexually humiliate him. They would put him in extreme hot temperatures, extreme cold temperatures, stress positions, things along those lines. Things that we've been hearing about a lot. But this was something that was happening to him a long time ago. And the way that we found out about this was there was a torture log that was leaked, and I believe it was to Newsweek or Time magazine, and it was Mohammed al-Qahtani's torture log. And we could actually see, they wrote down all of the things that they did to torture this guy. And on the front of the torture log, there was a handwritten inscription. And in the torture log, they talked about how they made Mohammed al-Qahtani stand in stress positions for hours at a time, 4 or 5 hours a day. And in handwritten on the top, it said, why only 4 or 5 hours? I myself stand 8 hours at my desk. DR. And the DR was Donald Rumsfeld. So Donald Rumsfeld's fingerprints were on this torture log, and that's how things began to come together for the range of people about actually how high up this torture regime was happening. But why this is important for the military commissions is this. As these cases were moving forward in the military commissions, we began to expose all of the torture that Muhammad al-Qahtani had experienced. And very abruptly, the military dismissed his case. And they, as of right now, they have not charged him again. And we suspected at the time, and it was actually confirmed after Barack Obama left office, but before he, I'm sorry, after he was elected, but before he went into office, it was by the military's supervisor of the military commissions. She came out, and she said the reason why Muhammad al-Qahtani's case was dismissed was because she ordered it dismissed because the torture that was used was so brutal that there was no way she could sustain a conviction even in a military commissions court. So we have a situation where the interrogation techniques that the Bush administration used combined with the illegal and unlawful legal systems that they were trying to put in began to clash, even to the point where you couldn't try somebody because they were treated so badly, even in a fake court where it's impossible not to get a conviction. So that really began to encapsulate our push and other human rights groups' pushes against the military commissions as a form of justice. We believe, and submit to you, that men who are charged or in Guantanamo who have committed a crime are perfectly capable of being tried in U.S. federal courts. And the only reason why George Bush didn't want to do that is because he was torturing these guys to begin with and that they were afraid they wouldn't be able to use evidence obtained by torture in U.S. federal courts. And that's why they created the military commission system. Well, let's fast forward a little bit to the election season. We had John McCain and we had Barack Obama, and both of them advocated for the closure of Guantanamo fairly convincingly. They both said that as a system, as a symbol, rather, Guantanamo was not sustainable. It was not the direction that the country should be going in, and it needed to be closed down. Barack Obama had also said of the military commissions that George Bush had put in place, that he was not in favor of them, that they were unsustainable, they were illegal, they were problematic, and that was not something that he supported. But the election comes, and Barack Obama is moving much more clearly towards stepping away from the George Bush policies with respect to detention and torture and moving into his own paradigm. You might remember that for both the Democrats and the Republicans, no one was talking about civil liberties. Nobody was talking about Guantanamo in the early part of the election. People didn't want to touch that. It was toxic. But as we got closer, it began to look like Barack Obama and was moving towards changing these policies. Well, Barack Obama gets elected, and very shortly after his inaugural day, he issues a series of executive orders. And one of the executive orders that he issues, of course, says that the United States will no longer torture people, which was a fabulous, fabulous executive order. It was a long time in coming. It was a breath of fresh air, and I personally felt very proud that we actually had a president for once that was going to stand up to do the right thing and stand up so decisively in the first couple of days of his presidency. One of the other executive orders that he issued was to close Guantanamo in a year. Similarly, I felt that that was an incredibly bold move. He was keeping true to what he had told us on the campaign trail. And he was acting in the context of the rule of law, looking at our American values, saying this is something that we have got to get rid of, and there have to be better ways for us to keep each other safe rather than creating this abomination that is actually, I think, making us less safe. For every day that the men remain in Guantanamo, I think we are breeding terrorist sympathizers around the world. So the faster that we close it down, I think the better off we're going to be. And I think that was President Obama's calculus as well. Well, which brings us to today. And it brings us to yesterday. I was very fortunate to receive a phone call to be invited to the White House on Wednesday, May 20th, in which a number of human rights groups began to engage in a discussion with President Obama about what his thinking was on national security. And I can't talk about the substance of that meeting, but I will tell you that the way that I went into the meeting was much different from the way that I came out. I went in feeling very hopeful, but also, again, proud in only the way that a dissenter can, where the center had been spending so much time being critical on the Bush administration policies, and frankly, even with respect to Barack Obama, there were a range of things that we challenged him to do within his first 100 days that he has not done. We asked him to end the state secrets privilege, you know, the idea of kicking cases out of court because of a broad national security paradigm. That wasn't done. We asked him to end warrantless wiretapping, and that wasn't done. We asked him to step up the timeline for the men in Guantanamo. That wasn't done. We asked him to release some of the men to foreign countries, and that's in the process of happening. But I was proud because, as someone who is such a vocal critic of bad policies, that I could be invited to the White House, where the White House didn't fear criticism. This Obama White House doesn't fear criticism the way that the Bush White House did. And I went in feeling very hopeful and very and very proud of that. And I came out of the meeting very uneasy. And what made me uneasy, I think, became clear in his speech today. There were a range of things where I felt that President Obama is on the right track. He is looking at things within the right framework. But I don't think that President Obama has enough political support, frankly, in Congress in order to get things done. When, you know, today it was a very symbolic moment. He was standing in the National Archives before the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence, and as he is wont to do, gave a tremendously stirring, motivational speech. I mean, I almost hate to call them speeches because they're so good. You know, speeches don't really seem to do justice. I'm not sure what I would call it. But I was watching that, and I was feeling very moved that he was moving us in the right direction. But then we got to two issues that, frankly, trouble me, one of which I think is a continuation of the George Bush policies, and the other one I actually think and fear will become the Obama legacy of illegality. And the one that, in terms of continuing the George Bush policies, Barack Obama has revived the military commissions. The military commissions have been defeated twice. We were involved in both of them. They were defeated in 2006, they were defeated in 2008, and now President Obama is bringing them back. Now, why is he doing this? Why would military commissions be something that President Obama thinks is a good, doable, and importantly legal thing to do? I think that he thinks it's a good thing to do because, as he defines the men in Guantanamo in particular, they fall into five categories. The first category of people are people who can be released to foreign countries, people who have already been cleared for release, people that have been ordered released through habeas corpus proceedings, people that can go and be tried in federal criminal courts, and then people who can be tried by military commissions. And then he created another category, which I'll get to later. But in the military commissions, the way that he defines it is that if you are caught, for example, on the battlefield in Afghanistan, and it's a violation of a law of war that you are trying to kill U.S. Soldiers, for example, the law already actually exists for the president to detain people on the battlefield for periods of time for the duration of that war. It is relatively uncontroversial. So it leads you to the question, well, if that's something that's already existing in the law, why would we have to create a new rule? Well, here's where it gets fuzzy. What happens if you pick up somebody but they're not in Afghanistan, that they're, you know, in Southeast Asia, and you have intelligence that they are beginning to commit a plot to blow up a U.S. embassy? What do you do with those folks? And I think that's where President Obama was looking in terms of these military commissions. The problem is that these type of crimes fall fairly neatly into two categories. They're either law of war crimes or they're criminal violations. There really isn't a third category of activity that you can detain people for And throw them in jail or execute them or do whatever it is that you want to do. So the point is that there's this third category that people are afraid of. And rather than looking to fit that category into two existing and, frankly, fairly buoyant legal systems, that there's a push to create a third category. And the problem with President Obama's iteration of this is that he essentially said in his speech today, for the men who we don't feel we can try in military commissions, we need to think about another way to handle these guys. So the military commissions piece is deeply troubling because he is perpetuating George Bush's view of another way to try folks. And he is adding a little bit of due process to that. He's saying, well, for example, they'll be able to choose their lawyers. Now, I'll tell you, and these are JAG lawyers, these are military lawyers, and it's a good thing to be able to choose your lawyer. The problem is that for the men that have been in Guantanamo, most of the men have essentially gone insane. They have been abused and isolated for so long that most of these men are incapable of making a rational choice that I would like to pick lawyer A over lawyer B, number one. Number two, because of the way that they've been held and the manner in which they've been picked up, that they harbor such suspicion with respect to the military, most of the men would rather die, whether they've done something or not, than be represented by a military official because they feel like these are the same people that have been abusing me for the last 7 years. So I'm not going to put my faith in these folks. So giving people that right to choose their lawyer is essentially meaningless, but it sounds good. It's more than George Bush did. And some people might say, well, if Barack Obama is doing something more than George Bush did, that's good enough for me. But I'm here to tell you, that's not so much. You know, another thing that that President Obama said is that these military commissions will not be able to use evidence obtained by torture. And that sounds really great. It also sounds consistent with what he's been telling us about banning torture by the military. But here's the problem. While it does ban evidence obtained by torture, it doesn't ban evidence that's coerced. And what's the difference? The difference is if you hang somebody by their thumbs from the ceiling and beat them and say, tell me what you did, and the person says what they did, that's torture. And the evidence of saying what they did stems from the fact that you were physically or psychologically torturing them. Coercion is different. Coercion is more along the lines of, tell me what you did, or I will hang you by your thumbs and beat you. Or, we know where your family lives, and right now we have them in custody, whether it's true or not, and if you don't tell us, we're going to start hanging them from the ceiling. So you're essentially getting testimony that is not true, or at least is tainted, because you're threatening someone with physical harm, or you're threatening somebody else with physical or psychological harm. But that latter category, coerced evidence, is allowed in the military commissions. And not only that, the hearsay rules, and hearsay is essentially if I'm talking to you and I say the sky is blue, I'm telling you that the sky is blue. If you tell somebody else that Vince said the sky is blue, that's not admissible because I'm not the person in court to be able to verify that that's true. So hearsay is sort of somebody saying what somebody else said. But hearsay is allowed in military commissions to the extent that it's not allowed in federal courts. So if someone else in another part, in Bagram Air Force Base, is being held by their thumbs or threatened to be held by their thumbs, and they say, Vince did this horrible thing, they can use that evidence against me because it's even coerced hearsay. And there's never been a system in the United States in the history of the Republic in which coerced evidence and involuntary evidence, meaning that I'm not telling you this voluntarily, I'm telling this because you're making me, where those two pieces of evidence are being able to be used to convict someone. And those two elements are apparent in Barack Obama's military commissions. So it is essentially lipstick on a pig. And it is something in which a little due process does not solve a horrible problem. It's very much like trying to refab a house on a toxic waste site. The house might look great, but you're still on the toxic waste site. You have to remember also that this is the military that are running these trials, and this is the same military that was very deep in the torture dynamic with respect to these men and with respect to others. So you have to also figure out who is actually responsible for meeting out justice in this system. The whole thing doesn't work. I think President Obama knows better than this, but I think that he probably feels that he has to grapple with the hard question of what do you do with people when we're afraid they might get acquitted in federal court. Finally, the other thing where I think he is setting a legacy, and this is my fear, that will come back to haunt him, and it is something that I don't think he can very easily blame on George Bush, is when he talked today about, well, what happens to the guys that you can't even try in the military commissions? This is a special category of people. And as he said today, these are folks that are so dangerous that we can't let them go no matter what. So we need to think of a system, these are his words, of prolonged detention. And I thought a long time about what does he mean by prolonged detention? Because 7 years was prolonged detention. If you're, you know, what does that mean? But it literally means creating a detention system for people who have yet to commit crimes, because you can't charge them with those crimes, and holding them for whatever period of time the government wants to hold them for. That's called preventive detention. That means that you're not being held for what you did. You're being held either because you're dangerous or because the government has information that you might do something and you're too dangerous to be on the street. And in a time of fear, post-September 11th, that might make a lot of sense to a lot of people. But if we stop and think about the documents that President Obama was standing in front of, if we stop to think about some of the things that he said at the at his speech, he said, you know, we must enlist the power of our own fundamental values to keep us safe. He said George Bush made a series of hasty decisions, and he made these decisions based on fear and not on foresight. He said that during this time of fear, most people in the world, in the country, fell silent. The theme that he was talking about in the beginning of his speech was that we should not let fear design our legal systems for us. Yet at the same time, what I'm seeing is the military commissions and the preventive detention scheme is really based on the fear, and it's two sets of fears. One, it's a fear that the system itself won't work. Well, God forbid we should send these guys to federal court, because what if they get convicted? And then it's based on the fear of the person themselves. Well, this guy is so dangerous, we can't even put him in any court system. And that's the fundamentals of what President Obama was talking about today. I don't want to leave us on a very negative note. I'm just trying to lay out for you, I think, the paradigm. Let me talk a little bit about what needs to happen to fix this. What needs to happen, first of all, is Congress. I can't begin, you know, hope springs eternal. You know, they told us to forget it when we filed the first habeas corpus petition, and they told us to forget it when we filed criminal charges against Donald Rumsfeld in Germany, and they told us to forget it when we represented Meher Arar, the Canadian citizen that was sent to Syria to be tortured. But we didn't forget it. And the reason why we didn't forget it is because the rule of law, reestablishing, reconnecting with our fundamental values, is more than just a good speech, and it's more than a lot of bipartisan wrangling in Congress. It is literally about saying what must be said and doing what must be done. And what must be said here is that every time over the last 8 years that someone has come up with a proposal for how to deal with the terrorism suspects, you can always count on Dick Cheney and the Republicans to roll out the fear carpet. And that's exactly what's happening. It's the old rope-a-dope, and it's the congressional Democrats that are continuing to fall for it. It's really outrageous that they could stand behind President Obama and say, we're behind you with when you're going to close Guantanamo, and then to come out yesterday and say, but we're not going to give you the money for it until you give us a plan. That's ridiculous. The leadership that President Obama needs from Congress is absolutely critical. Congress is creating essentially an American gulag by saying we're not going to give you the money to close Guantanamo. When Harry Reid stands up and says nobody from Guantanamo is going to come to American soil, whether they come in chains, in shackles, in a box, or they're released. That is essentially telling to President Obama, we are not standing behind you when you said you were going to close Guantanamo in a year, because there's no way he can do it without Congress, and he knows that. So the first thing that needs to happen is that Congress needs to get a backbone, and I am counting on all of you to talk to your various congressional representatives and tell them that. The second thing that needs to happen is that we need to change the paradigm of fear. It is the fear that always keeps us from doing the right thing, and that's not just in the context of national security. That is always the same thing in terms of the hard cases. It's fear of speaking up when you know that something is not right. It's fear of taking a risk and sticking to your fundamental principles when other people are criticizing you. That is really what's at the essence of what our role is moving forward, is that we have to accept, as I think we all do at some level, that there is likely going to be another terrorist attack. I think we do need to accept that. And once we've accepted that, then we have to disrobe ourselves of the notion that there is anything in either Dick Cheney's plan, frankly, or Barack Obama's plan that is going to make it a surety that it won't happen. There is always the risk of this, and we want to be smart about it, but we don't want to sacrifice our rights, and we don't want to sacrifice the rights of the people that we are detaining in order to try to justify this irrational fear that's floating around. That's another very important piece of what we need to be saying to Congress, and we need to be saying it to ourselves. Last thing I'll say on this piece is, you know, for Harry Reid to come out and say, we're afraid of terrorists coming into our backyard, pretending that there are no convicted terrorists locked up in the United States right now, right? There was Zacharias Massawi, the 20th hijacker. He's in a supermax prison. There was Richard Reid. He's in jail. There was Timothy McVeigh. He was in jail. The Unabomber's in jail. All of these guys are in these supermax prisons. Nobody's hearing a peep out of these guys, but there's something about the guys in Guantanamo that seem to change that paradigm, and it doesn't make sense. Another weird thing, I don't know if you guys read about this today, I'm going to forget the man's name, but as we're having this discussion, the administration is sending a man from Guantanamo to the federal courts in New York to be tried in Article III courts. And I will say, as critical as I am of his policies, President Obama deserves deep, deep praise because it is the first time that anybody from Guantanamo has been transferred anywhere for a fair trial. This is the first time, and it's a shame that in the blaze of all of the bad policy ideas that I think he's coming out with, that this gets lost. But at the same time that this man is being sent to New York to undergo trial from Guantanamo, nobody is complaining about that. I think people fundamentally feel like that's probably a good thing, as long as he's going to get his trial. So there's this false sense of fear that somehow, if President Obama is going to unlock the doors of Guantanamo and we're going to have terrorists running around in our backyards. That is not the case. It is that type of fear-mongering that has worked. This entire national security discussion all these years later with a new president, a Democrats in control of Congress, is still being played on the Republican battlefield. It's only been 5 months, but it is still being played on the Republican battlefield. It's all of their talking points. And that's, of course, why Dick Cheney's agent is so happy, because that guy, that brother gets on any television show he wants. He doesn't even have a job. So let me close by saying that there are things that we can do. We need to be vigilant as we begin to think about compromises in our legal system for the sake of the feeling of security. We need to be vigilant that the documents that we can't have President Obama standing in front of some of the most sacred documents in our democracy talking about how revered they are, but at the same time undoing them with bad policies. So I want to thank you all very much.
Thank you to Vincent Warren for his comments this evening. My name is Goodwin Liu. I'm an associate dean and professor of law at the Bolt Hall School of Law at UC Berkeley, and I'm going to be moderating the Q&A session this evening. I have in front of me 25 questions and about 25 minutes. And so let me just say that if you factor in the amount of time it's going to take me to ask these questions, that leaves Mr. Warren about 36 seconds to answer every single question. So we're not going to do that. What I'm going to try to do is synthesize a little bit all the different questions that have come in front of me. And let me begin by asking a question specifically about Vice President Cheney, former Vice President Cheney's speech today, which he gave in a sort of nicely timed manner, shall we say. One of the things he said is that with respect to enhanced interrogation, known to other people as torture, the Obama administration has released a variety of memos over the course of the last few weeks that detail the legal bases and the actual practices that were committed by in the name of the United States against these terrorist suspects. His argument has always been, well, that's, he said today, less than half the truth, because the Obama administration has not declassified the information about what we got from the enhanced interrogation techniques. And so how is the American people supposed to judge whether or not those techniques are worth it if all we have are questions about how we question people rather than the content of the answers that we got? What's your response to that?
My response is that you don't judge the validity of torture by the results. You judge the validity of torture by the law. And we are talking about an unequivocally illegal act. It's illegal under U.S. law. It's illegal under international law. And quite frankly, if they tortured people and they got the most amazing information ever, in a court of law, in a real court of law, that information would not be allowed. And it's not because it's a pro-defendant court. It is because the fundamental idea of torturing people for any reason, much less to try to get information, is absolutely abhorrent. So my answer to Dick Cheney is that if the best that you can do is to try to justify an illegal action based upon memos of intelligence that you've gotten, you're missing the point. The point is that you need to really recognize that torture is never justifiable under any circumstances, and that is why it's a crime against humanity.
Let me keep going down that line of questions. So I suspect that Vice President Cheney's answer to that might be to say, well, and he said this in today's speech, you know, whatever else can be said about the Bush-Cheney administration, it can be said that in the 7.5 years after September 11th, 2001, there was not another terrorist attack on domestic soil. And so, you know, I think his speech was sort of the tenor, you can say whatever you want about the illegality of torture, which he disputes, of course, but the fact is, we kept America safe. And if the next administration doesn't keep America safe, then that's the only yardstick, really, by which you know, our administration versus the next administration should be judged.
Yeah, it's a lot like crime rates and the Boston Red Sox. It's like crime rates in the sense that crime rates rise and fall on their own. And in a period of declining crime rates, for example, since 1994, the juvenile crime rate has completely gone down. Every sheriff, every little town sheriff and major police chief is claiming credit for what they put into place that has actually reduced the crime rate. What they have done has very little, if no, relationship to the actual crime rate. And similarly here, that this is another version of the Republican rope-a-dope, and it's actually the Republicans didn't make it up, but I think it's fairly effective. You can tell what we're doing is effective because there hasn't been another terrorist attack. That's the first part of it. The second part of it is, if you don't give us more power, you're going to make it more likely that there's going to be another terrorist attack. If there is another terrorist attack, they'll say, you didn't give us as much power as we wanted. Had you given us more power, that terrorist attack wouldn't have occurred. The point is that there is a relationship between policy and the ability of terrorists to do bad things, but that relationship does not hinge on the power of the presidency. It hinges on whether the intelligence agency are working well. It hinges on balancing what they need to do with our fundamental civil liberties, but it has nothing to do with George Bush's plan versus Barack Obama's plan. And in fact, President Obama is getting set up. It's very easy at the end of your tenure to say, nothing happened on my watch. What is the likelihood that something's going to happen on Barack Obama's watch? It's a setup.
Well, last question on this subject. There are several questions in front of me of the following variety. the president, President Obama, has said that he is not interested, and he reiterated the point today in his speech, he's not interested in a backward-looking inquiry into culpability for the legal authorization or the actual practice of enhanced interrogation techniques that may violate the law. He has rejected consistently the idea of a so-called truth commission or commission of inquiry into those practices, saying that they are that would essentially be a distraction. Do you agree?
Disagree. I think President Obama is missing the point, and the point is that in order for President Obama to really change the Bush administration policies, he's got to do three things. One is he actually has to change the policy, like he did on torture. The other thing that he needs to do is he needs to reject the underlying rationale, legal and otherwise, for those policies. And the first step of that is the release of the memos. They get out there, and he and Eric Holder can say, I categorically reject that analysis. But the third part, and probably the most important part, is how do you ensure that it never happens again? And one of the best ways to ensure that it never happens again in terms of accountability is the threat, the possibility, the availability of criminal prosecution for illegal activity. President Obama can have all the policies in the world, and we can all feel very good about them, and they will last exactly as long as his tenure as the president. Dick Cheney has told us today and in the past, if I had it to do all over again, I would do it again. The next president that comes in is not or her administration is not circumscribed by anything but their own conscience, unless we have a system in place where we have recognized that there are crimes that have been committed. There must be accountability, and the best way to do that is to have a criminal investigation to make sure that future presidencies are not tempted to do this again.
Next question. President Obama spoke today about transparency, and he contrasted two decisions that he made, one to release the torture memos versus his decision recently to reverse course on releasing photos of the sort of Abu Ghraib abuse variety on the grounds that the latter would compromise national security interests by being misused by our enemies to inflame opinion and turn the tables against the U.S. military serving abroad. This, of course, was greeted with dismay by folks like the ACLU and others. What did you make of President Obama's contrast between these two decisions?
There was a compelling point that I think he made with respect, and I don't agree with it, but I'm just going to articulate the compelling point, which was that the pictures at issue, and these are roughly several thousand pictures that come from Abu Ghraib that actually stem from a lawsuit that was a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that was filed jointly by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU and Physicians for Human Rights, that they came out, these pictures came out through a criminal investigation. The people that were responsible for these, for doing the acts in these pictures have already been sanctioned, and therefore it doesn't make sense to release those pictures because it's never going to happen again. The people have already been sanctioned, and it will only inflame the rest of the world. And I think that does make some sense. I think the problem is that the president is trying to, well, no, I'm not going to say that he's trying to, but it will have the effect of a larger problem, which is, again, going back to the accountability problem. People will trust that President Obama will not do this anymore. And people will probably trust his judgment about the timing of releasing these pictures. However, the transparency is an absolutely key thing. We represent, interestingly enough, Center for Constitutional Rights, 338 people in Iraq. And we have a lawsuit against the Khaki and Titan corporations, which are contractors that did the interrogations and abuse in Iraq. So we have plaintiffs, some of whom may very well be depicted in these pictures, I don't know. But we have plaintiffs that know what happened in that prison. There are thousands of people in Iraq that know what happened in those prisons. And for us to say, well, we're not going to show photos of what has happened in those prisons is a tremendous disservice to the human beings that suffered under American hands in those prisons. And it's not fooling anybody. I would suggest to the president, what's better for you to do is why don't you take the affirmative step of releasing the pictures, and say, I am releasing this because I want to show you what happened in the past, and I'm going to demonstrate how this is not going to happen in the future, and there will be a regime of accountability if people do this stuff moving forward. I think, given the person that he is, very, very compelling human being, if there's anybody on the planet who can make that argument that I'm being open, I'm not trying to hide and make excuses for the Bush administration, but we're going to move forward, it's him. And I think the proper way for him to do it, history is likely going to show, is to release those pictures. And I think as a practical matter, you have to imagine that the pictures are going to be leaked by somebody. The last pictures were. And if I were him, I would want to be out in front of that and to claim it rather than have to try to justify it later.
Let me pause the questions for 1 minute just to say that for our radio listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Vincent Warren, the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who is assessing the Obama administration's commitment to upholding constitutional principles. Let me ask the next question, and it relates to Guantanamo. And this relates to what President Obama today called the fifth category of individuals at Guantanamo, meaning those people who are deemed dangerous. Apparently there's some evidence that some number of people truly are dangerous, and yet they cannot be prosecuted, neither in military commission nor in regular civilian court. And the inference there, I think, is that the evidence is perhaps tainted in some way, whether by coercion, torture, et cetera. What do you propose we do about those individuals?
This category of individuals is vexing. And it's vexing because based on the information that we have, and we might very well have clients that are in this fifth category. The president hasn't made that determination yet. But based on the evidence that we have, that there may very well be sufficient information to convict people if that's what the prosecution chooses to do. What you'll notice is that the government will use as a foregone conclusion, these guys just simply can't be tried in these other courts. I would challenge people, you know, on the radio or in this room to try to recall a specific articulation as to actually why that is. The general mantra is, well, because people were tortured, and so since we can't use evidence of torture in these cases, we therefore would be forced to release them, and so they'll be out on the street. And I don't think that's actually true at all. I mean, I think as a practical matter, it's hard to imagine even someone like Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, who, when he was before he was even picked up, was very vocal about what he had done and what he was going to do. And I don't think that it necessarily means for a lot of these people that all of the information is tainted by tortured activity. I don't buy as a basic premise until I'm shown that we have to create a new court from scratch on the fly just based on the government say-so that they can't get a conviction in the good old court. That's something that this country has never done before, and that's not a road that I'm really comfortable going down. And so the answer is, it's not my job as a human rights advocate to design a system, a prosecutorial system, that is fair and that is effective. My job as a human rights advocate is to identify amongst the systems that we do have and to caution against creating new systems that violate the Constitution.
Let me turn to, still sticking on the Guantanamo subject, to the second.
I'm sorry, can I ask the question that really follow up? Because it doesn't make sense to me. If you're saying federal, are you saying it should be federal court?
Let me ask that you write your question down so I can get it into the mic.
You know, let me just jump in. I just to clarify my remarks. I did say that it's not my job to define a new system to try people. But I think to be clear, my view is that all of the men can be prosecuted in federal courts in the United States. They do not need to be prosecuted by military commissions, and they do not need to be housed indefinitely in detention.
Let me turn to the military commissions point, because this was, President Obama's second category of people. He said that when it comes to violations of the law of war, we think that military commissions could be an appropriate venue. It strikes me that this, as you mentioned in your talk, in some ways aligned with the previous administration's basic position against the idea that military commissions, as the Supreme Court said in the 2006 decision that you litigated, are only to be used in times of emergency. That is really the only basis for using military tribunals is when regularly constituted courts are not available. So let me ask you this. If President Obama is successful in implementing his version of the military commissions, how likely do you think the Supreme Court of the United States would strike that down?
It might depend on who the new Supreme Court justice is. It's a very good question, and I think that the box that the administration finds itself in, as did the last administration, is that the courts only do recognize the use of these courts in emergency situations, and emergencies, by definition, are limited periods of time, that they don't move forward indefinitely. And that's a real question. I think that there's a very good chance, that were the system to go into place, were some of our clients or other people's clients put into this system and those and their rights to challenge the system were afforded, I think there's a very good chance that the Supreme Court would strike down in whole or in part some elements of this military commission system.
Let me ask you further about the Supreme Court. Do you have any advice for President Obama in picking the next justice?
Yeah, he needs to pick somebody good. I would sort of throw it out this way. We have all been very, very disappointed with the way the Supreme Court has handled a range of issues that, you know, that go far beyond Guantanamo. Issues of women's rights, issues of reproductive freedom, issues of workers' rights, discrimination cases. There has been a tremendous erosion with respect to all of those rights that were developed meticulously, largely over the last 30 years for a lot of them. And that I would like to see a Supreme Court justice that is open to the idea of looking at these cases not in a purely ideological way, but also sees themselves, as we're seeing now, becomes very important, is very independent from the administration that actually appoints them. So the independence, and I think someone who is really focused and has an experience with dealing with a range of these issues that are going to be coming up in the national security context, but also the issues that we've been losing on for the last 10 years pretty solidly.
Let me ask you about a different subject also covered today by President Obama in his speech, state secrets. So I think in the early period, the last few months, there has been some dismay that the administration has continued, in effect, the litigation position of the prior administration to assert state secrets privilege, essentially to defeat not even certain forms of evidence, but the entire lawsuits altogether, inquiring into various government practices in prosecuting the war on terrorism. President Obama says that he's going to implement some new standards and some new processes for when the government will assert the state secret privilege. What's your view on that?
It's about time. I think the administration had a golden opportunity earlier this year in a case that was out here in California, the Jeppesen Data Plan case, where a series of rendition victims, people that were sent to different countries to be tortured, sued the airline company that flew them there in the context of the lawsuit, which was between the victims and the corporation. The government intervened and said, whoa, 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 this case can't go forward because there are national security issues that are at stake, and essentially sought to have the entire case dismissed. And it creates this interesting paradigm, this interesting situation where you have the torture victims that can go on national television, if people would have them on their show, and talk about all the horrible things that were done. But the only place that they can't talk about it is in a federal court where they're trying to seek justice because the government says you can't talk about this stuff because it's state secrets. Literally, they could go on television and say, here's what happened to me, but they couldn't do the same thing in court and get the evidence from the corporation. So it's a long time coming. We'd have to see what the plan is that he lays out, but we're very concerned that this administration would be tempted to use national security as a way to keep secret not only legitimate national security issues, but also the couching things that aren't so good as national security issues the way that the last administration did.
Let me turn now to another subject, and that is surveillance or eavesdropping. Another claim made by Vice President Cheney today was that the terrorist surveillance program, so-called, was successful in the sense of interdicting actionable intelligence that led to the ability to avert various terrorist plots. And the dynamic behind that has been that when the program was actually surfaced by the New York Times and others, the Congress of the United States eventually passed a series of amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which essentially gave some more latitude to the executive branch to conduct this kind of surveillance. Is that essentially the end of the story on surveillance? In other words, the fundamental issue of individual privacy has never been actually litigated to a conclusion. And so we've only been wrangling about whether different actors in the political system have power to do this. And I think there's perhaps, some would say, something of a detente on that issue. But the fundamental issue of individual privacy has never been fully joined. So is that issue over?
That's a very, Professor Liu, I'm glad that you raised it because it's a very vexing problem. I think that what Professor Liu is referring to is the fact that a number of these cases have been filed, and it's hard to challenge a secret wiretapping program when you don't know that you're being wiretapped. And the law requires that there be a plaintiff, a person with a case or controversy before a federal court. And so you have to be able to say, hi, I'm the guy that's being secretly wiretapped in order for your case to move forward. So a lot of these cases have been kicked out because people have come up with creative ways to try to raise that issue. I don't think the issue is over by a long shot, and for a number of reasons. And this goes to the transparency issue. In the context of the Freedom of Information Act cases, I suspect, and I've been hearing, that there are a range of documents and, frankly, a range of policy considerations that certainly were in place in the Bush administration and I have not heard have been changed in this new administration that go far beyond, I think, what the government has said that this national security situation is. That there's a tremendous group of organizations, including the Electronic Freedom Foundation here in San Francisco, that are doing tremendous work on these issues. These issues are not going to go away. I do think that at some point more information, more people are going to come forward, either from the telecoms or from inside the National Security Agency, and they're going to say, here's what's going on, which is, of course, how we find out about these things to begin with, through whistleblowers. So it may be a pause. But I think that we haven't seen the last of this at all, and I think this is going to fall on the current administration's plate as well.
We've reached the point in the program where there's time for just one last question, and so let me put this one to you. When President Obama, a few years from now, is campaigning for re-election, what do you hope or predict he will be able to say to the American people on this broad range of issues under the banner of his promise to restore the rule of law?
I think President Obama will have a lot more to say about the economy than he will about restoring the rule of law. I think what he will say is that he has taken steps taken meaningful steps to close the base of Guantanamo. He will likely, in a second term, be able to shut down the system of indefinite detention by clearing out the men that are currently there. He will be challenged with the new issue, which is not so much what do you do with the 240 men that are in Guantanamo, but what do you do with the guys that you capture moving forward. And I think that he will either be in a world of hot water because he has created draconian and legal systems for illegal detention and prolonged detention, or he will have abandoned those, having had more than 5 months on the job to think this through, having all of his policy people in place, and will have come up with a better solution that is more in line with the Constitution, the international human rights norms, and the values that we hold dear.
Let me draw the program to a close by thanking our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's U.S. Constitution in the 21st Century series, underwritten by the Charles Geschke family. I want to extend a special thanks to Vincent Warren, the Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'm Professor Goodwin Liu of Bolt Hall, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.